There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Coming up, we're going to hear from a big name in motor racing. We'll look at what 2019 could hold for the construction sector here in the UAE. And we'll find out about a private members club for people who fly around on private jets. But first, the business headlines.
Business headlines.
The troubled retailer Marker Holding, which owns the Reem Al Bawadi restaurant chain, has lost its second CEO in 2 years. Benoit Lemonnery has resigned, citing personal reasons.
The UAE Central Bank is pledging to help Sharjah-based InvestBank amid reports of problems with bad loans. Earlier in the week, Sharjah government promised to inject cash into the bank.
Google Pay has been rolled out across the UAE by the country's biggest payments operator, Network International. Google Pay users can now use their phones in thousands of UAE stores.
Dubai is creating a new business zone targeting small companies in a historic part of the city on the banks of the creek. The Al Seif SME district is part of a development by Miras in Bur Dubai.
Central Bank of the World is warning investors that 2019 looks like being a pretty tough year on the markets. The Bank for International Settlements, or the BIS, issued the warning in a new report.
And an Emirates passenger flight will make a rear stop in Abu Dhabi today, but it's got nothing to do with any aviation mega merger. Emirates sponsors Spanish football club Real Madrid and is flying the team to Abu Dhabi for the FIFA Club World Cup.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Do you fancy yourself as part of the jet set? We've been speaking to a man this morning who's got a new club, but it's not a given that he'll let you in. You need to have quite a bit of money first. We're speaking to Asad Rahman, who is the CEO of Jet Set. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to explain to us exactly what Jet Set is and how it works?
So Jet Set X is a new private members club that we will be launching in Dubai. We have already launched in London, and we're looking to launch across other cities in North America over the next 6 months. Jetset X is essentially limited to 120 members, and the concept is you pay a one-off membership fee and you become a member for 5 years. In those 5 years, you have access to a brand new Falcon 8X aircraft, which is a 6,000 nautical mile plus 14-hour non-stop private jet, so it can take you from Dubai to pretty much anywhere. So you have access for 5 years. You're able to share it with other members. You're able to take the aircraft to yourself as well at a cost price rate rather than a market price rate.
So your membership fee obviously doesn't cover the plane. You then have to pay for how much you use the plane separately.
Sure. But you pay, rather than pay sort of the cost of the aircraft and then a margin on top, which most operators do charge, you just pay the actual running cost of the aircraft.
What's the membership fee?
The membership fee at the moment is on application, but it's far less than what you would find on the market today.
Oh, come on, give us an idea. Give us a ballpark. consider this an application.
Okay, so under $1 million.
Well, that's good. Can you be a bit more specific than that?
I can't at the moment.
That's $1 million a year.
Yes. Not a year. So it's a one-off payment you pay.
For 5 years.
And then for 5 years you're in the club.
Okay, so you're talking about $200,000 a year. What do I get for that, Rick? Apart from the fact that if I only flew once, what would I get?
So essentially you pay a one-off membership fee at the beginning of 5 years, and then you don't pay any other fee for those 5 years apart from a very small service charge. What you get is you have the ability to fly on effectively an $80 million private jet at cost. So if you were to join, let's say, any other program currently being offered here in the Gulf, you would be paying the cost of operation plus a margin, in some cases quite a substantial one. So what we've tried to do with Jetset X is bring the cost of sort of part ownership and aviation clubs far lower. Our client base is your average regular first class flyer rather than just your private charter.
The Richard Deans of the world.
Yes.
How much are you then paying for the actual plane. You say it's below the market cost. I'm not even sure, unfortunately, what market cost for a private jet is.
So essentially what happens when you join one of these programs or if you're flying charter is that they'll sort of charge you the cost of running the aircraft plus a margin on top, which will cover their management fees.
Which would be roughly how much on a flight, supposing it cost me, I don't know, $20,000 to get from here to London on a private jet. How much would the margin be on top of that?
So I'll give you an example. One of the top operators here in the region will charge anything from $7,000 to $14,000 an hour of operation. So let's say the aircraft, if they're charging you $14,000, of that $14,000, only $7,000 of it is an actual cost to them. The remaining amount is a margin. So it's a fairly substantial one. And we're finding that now the charter market itself globally is booming. There's been huge increases across the board, especially in the North American markets. Dubai has seen growth, perhaps not as much at such a high rate as the US, but it's growing nonetheless. And I think, well, you know, with the run up to Expo 2020, we'll see that sort of building up. So you have people who are chartering more and more who now are looking for more innovative solutions. And I think over the last 5 years, we've seen that in the industry.
Why limit it to 120 people? Is that to give a feeling of exclusivity, or is that what you've worked out you need to make sure that a plane would be available when people needed it?
So the idea is that we don't want to sort of overload our aircraft to begin with. We want to keep it exclusive, and we want to be able to offer the right level of service, and we feel that at the 120 mark, you're in your perfect sort of window for what we want to do.
If I was a member, one of those 100 or so members, and I booked a plane to go from here to London, sure, for instance, and I pay for that, that would presumably take it out for what, one and a half days?
So effectively, if you were flying from, let's say, here to London, it's a six and a half hour leg on our aircraft. Yeah. So yeah, so it would take it out of Dubai for a
over
day.
Over half a day anyway.
Over
certainly.
Half a day, sure.
Do you see that sort of the one plane is going to be enough, or have you got more than one plane?
So the way it works is we've developed technology that goes along with this. This whole club is underpinned by next generation technology. So I myself have a background in that. We've spent the last 2 years at the University of Florida with a state grant from Florida to develop next generation technology for business aviation. And one of the things that we've developed is an algorithm which allows for, when we have our group of 120 people, how do you optimize the usage with those 120 people? And how do you ensure all those 120 people get what they want?
Especially as there are going to be bottlenecks, like for Eid or whatever else.
Exactly. So our algorithm, I mean, the easiest way to explain it without sort of boring everyone with the technicalities of it is it's sort of like a queuing system, except the way I want you to think of it is rather than these group of 120 people always wanting the aircraft themselves, a lot of them at this price point would be happy to share the aircraft with other members. Bear in mind, it's only a small membership pool. So what that means is it opens up the possibilities of higher usage far, far more.
But presumably, if I'm a member, I can take my family on the flight. I mean, from this part of the world, for example, do I need to have six memberships for everyone in my family, or would just one membership and then we could use the plane for the family be enough?
So, okay, there's two ways around that. The first one is when someone buys an individual membership, they're given a guest pass as part of that membership. Now, if there's like, let's say, for example, a family of four, the question we would ask is that how often do you fly as a family of four? If it's the vast majority of the time, we'd recommend buying two memberships. If not, all you do is you pay a higher rate pro rata for the other two guests. But then if you're taking the whole aircraft to yourself, then it's essentially up to you who's on that aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, taking what Malcolm said about Eid, I mean, once you've got sort of one or two families on board for the days that Eid starts or Eid finishes, are you going to bring on other planes for those peak
sure.
times?
No, exactly. So one of the things we have access to is a really wide database of aircraft worldwide. One of our other sort of technology sort of forays has been to build a private jet platform, which we've built. It's the world's first end-to-end booking platform, and there's about 3,500 private jets on that. So we work with operators around the world, and the idea is that although we have our core aircraft, which we would operate, if, for example, like the example you gave is Eid, we could pull in spare capacity from other aircraft, so it wouldn't really be a problem, really.
Very quick last question before we head over to the news. We've had a message in asking, who pays for the return leg, the empty plane coming back if you're just going somewhere and you're not coming back for a couple of days?
We do.
You do?
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Asad Rahman, who is CEO of Jet Set X. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Richard's been out about and chasing Formula One drivers. He's been chatting to David Coulthard.
It was a DEWA risk management conference, so lots of business people there, predominantly men in middle-aged men in suits, but not exclusively so.
All racing drivers tend to look tall because they're quite skinny, but he's nowhere near as tall as you, is he?
We didn't go back to back.
Didn't you?
But he's
your sort of height, is he?
He's
5'4".
He's not jockey height.
No, okay.
He's a very well-preserved, handsome 49-year-old male. I'll give him that. And lovely. Just a really nice, warm, friendly energy. And one of the things we were talking about was how he managed... The reason he was there was to talk about how he managed risk in Formula One. Very fast-paced, up to 400 kilometres an hour. How do you manage those risks? Because the thing with David Coulthard was his first race, as he explains now, 1994, he took over Ayrton Senna's seat at Williams after Ayrton Senna died.
Which was a heck of a task.
Exactly.
And at the deep end.
Before 1994, there were about 40 deaths in Formula One. Since then, there's been one, Jules Bianchi. So that was a watershed moment for Formula One in managing risks. And that's where I began talking to David Coulthard.
Well, I think that's the thing which is actually, even for myself, sometimes... complicated to fully understand, because I never considered that I was doing something risky whilst being fully aware of the fact that my very career in Formula One started through the death of one of the greatest drivers, Ayrton Senna. So the reason for that is that despite the fact that the speeds involved, and if you were to have an accident, then of course you could end up with an injury or a fatality, but I always felt that it was an engineering exercise, and we were finding engineering solutions to making a racing car, which basically the inverse of an aircraft. The aircraft generates lift and goes up into the sky. A Grand Prix car generates downforce and pushes it into the ground. So there was always a physical limit, a science project limit to how fast that car will go through the corner. And you don't go out and go flat out everywhere. You build up to the point where you find the limit of the car. And working with engineers and designers and people you trust in, you always go step by step towards that limit. So for me, it seemed like a very, methodical way to achieving high performance.
Well, that weekend when you first got a drive in a Formula One car really was a landmark for Formula One, wasn't it? Ayrton Senna died that weekend in Imola. Two people died that weekend in Imola. And Mark Gallagher, your friend, was telling me about some statistics about the number of deaths in Formula One before that weekend and the number since. So clearly Formula One changed something after that. What did you perceive?
Well, I think that under the leadership of Max Mosley, who was the president of the FIA, which is our governing body, he came out and made the statement that it just wasn't acceptable to have fatalities in Formula One. And that's not, I think, suggesting it was acceptable in the past, but it was just seen as part and parcel of how Grand Prix racing had evolved. And what he put in place was a series of changes and crash tests, like he was working with NCAP and road car crash testing, to do all of the sort of the pre-design and the pre-build to the point where that the limit of whether a driver would survive a crash or not was not down to the integrity of the car. It was down to, you know, humans' ability to handle the sort of decelerations. So there was a sort of parallel program between redesigning the cars, improving the crash testing, and also major redesigns of racetracks with a lot more science involved, to the point where you even if there was a barrier quite close to the circuit, like we'd have in Monte Carlo, the angle of impact would see the car continue before coming to a halt and therefore losing energy as it goes.
What about the risk management in real time? These are things that can be discussed in a boardroom months in advance, and great advances were made. But in real time, you have to make split-second decisions, thousands of them during a race. How did you approach that, either rationally but also psychologically?
Well, again, I never felt that I ever did anything that was beyond my capabilities. Of course, I had accidents where I found out I had gone beyond what my perception of the performance of the car or maybe what my capability was. But you're dealing with other elements like weather. You know, you might have a little bit of rain on the corner that wasn't there the previous lap. There might be some oil on the corner that wasn't there. So there's always going to be those sort of banana skins that occasionally we might slip up on. But in terms of making the sort of risk assessment, I always felt very much in control of the process. And even during a crash, I felt I was influencing the outcome of the crash by trying to lessen the impacts until the point where the car comes to a halt.
Can you give me an example of one of those?
Well, and I had a big crash in Spa 98 off the start line, and which triggered a series of incidents behind me, and it was probably one of the biggest start line incidents that we've ever seen in Formula One. But I was able to, with the fact that I was missing the front right corner of the car, I still had the front left, and I was still able to steer the car towards the side of the track, so getting myself out of the way of the other cars following. So you know you've made a mistake, you know you've crashed, you know that that's going to have a detrimental effect on your desires to win the Grand Prix, but you can still influence what's going on whilst the car's coming to a halt.
My colleague Malcolm, who I present the show with, says, can you ask David a cheeky question? Ask him, if he'd taken more risks, would he have been a Formula One world champion rather than runner-up?
Potentially. And I was at a talk the other day, and when Michael and I had the crash together in 98, when he was lapping me, we ran into the back of me, lost the front wheel of his car, and he lost winning that race. And there was a lot of energy and nervousness around whether that was a deliberate action by me and McLaren to try and help him and to help Mika Hakkinen, my teammate, against Michael. Now, of course, that's ridiculous that I could manufacture reversing into someone when I'm going the same direction as everyone else. So I had a meeting with Michael after, and I said, Michael, you have to accept some of the blame as well. You ran into the back of me, so you know I didn't want the leader to crash into me. And he said, well, I don't see why I should accept any of the blame. And I said, Michael, you must be wrong sometimes. And he thought for a while, and he went, not that I remember. And at that moment, I thought maybe that's the difference between being a multiple world champion and not winning a championship like myself, because I knew I was wrong on occasion. So maybe the absolute self-confidence he had, which sometimes I think took him beyond what I'd consider the sporting boundaries. You know, the sport is defined by a set of rules, and I think sometimes Michael went beyond those rules, and he didn't need to because he was so good. So that goes into another subject as to who is the best sporting champion that we've had rather than just the most successful champion.
That's David Coulthard, former Formula One racing driver. What did you reckon of his answer to you, Malcolm?
I think it's great. I really do. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, at what point do you cross that boundary between sensible risk and a risk that could get you into trouble? I mean, you know, obviously, given what happened to Michael Schumacher subsequently when skiing, you know, was he taking too much risk? Who knows? Nobody knows the answer to that one. But in general, you know, David Coulthard was criticised a bit for not taking enough risk and not winning enough, as many championships or races as he perhaps could have done. But I always enjoyed watching him drive. I mean, he was a very good driver within a set of boundaries. Well, I mean, was he before your time?
No, he was absolutely my time. Yeah. He's my age within a couple of years. So, yeah, he is front and centre.
Good on him.
My generation. Yeah. Top bloke. That was David Coulthard talking to me yesterday at the DWRT Risk and Resilience Conference.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
We're nearly at the end of the year, and it's the time of year that people start looking to 2019 and making predictions. We've had someone in the studio doing just that, having a look at what the new year could hold for the UAE and some of its vital sectors.
Joining us in the studio is the editorial director of the information provider Mead. He is Richard Thompson. Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fabulous. Thanks very much indeed. Top of your list, and you gave us a long, long list of the big stories of 2018 and what to look forward to in 2019. One word, oil. I'm going to ask you why in a second. But first of all, Richard, have a listen to this. This is someone you know well, Sahel Al-Masrawi. He's the UAE Energy Minister. He spent all year as the president of OPEC. This was him speaking just a week or so ago at the 175th OPEC meeting.
I am confident that all member countries will work together with the Secretariat and the new President in 2019 and with our non-OPEC partners to step up to the new challenges and continue our work to balance the market. I'm pleased to see so many ministers and heads of delegations with us today. This is again a sign that this cooperation is attracting more countries, not only to stay, but others to join.
That's Sahel Al-Mazrui, UAE Energy Minister. Richard, for you, why has oil been the story of the year?
I think because oil underpins so much, you know, looking from a business perspective, oil underpins so much of the outlook, the opportunities, the political landscape for business in the Middle East. And it's been a roller coaster ride throughout the year. As we've heard from the UAE oil minister there, this agreement between the OPEC producers and the non-OPEC producers over the past couple of years, they've worked really hard to try and bring some sort of balance back into the market. And we saw oil start the year at $60 a barrel, and that rebalancing of supply drove for the first 8 months of the year oil back up to a healthy price, and things started to look positive for next year. And then, of course, we had that sudden turnaround a couple of months ago with the Iran sanctions and the unexpected waivers from the US to some of their allies. That's then led us now into fears of a oversupply next year, and we're back to the roller coaster. So oil's back down to $60 where it was at the beginning of the year. And so I think that story, that unpredictability, that political realignment of the oil producers, the impact on the outlook for 2019, all of that makes it the number one business story for me.
So crystal ball, looking forward to 2019 for oil. This time next year, where's it going to be?
I think we're not going to be far off where we are, but I think there's going to be it's going to be a roller coaster as well. I think the OPEC producers and other producers have got a bit of a double-edged sword. If they cut output to try and push up the prices, that's going to boost the people, the US producers who are outside of their agreement.
Those pesky shale producers in the Permian Basin.
Meanwhile, if they increase output, the prices come down. So they're sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't. And I think we'll see. And that then ties in with the political relationships between OPEC and non-OPEC. And so I think we're going to see as roughly where we are now, but there's going to be a rough journey in between. The one concern is the outlook for global growth. So I think we're seeing, you know, with the threat of trade war and with increasing interest rates, what's that going to mean for global economic growth and global demand?
What does that mean a little bit more for projects here in the region? I mean, Mead, obviously, you're carrying all the tenders. You've got your fingers on the pulse of what's being built, infrastructure and building-wise. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's been a really terrible 3 years for anyone involved in construction and projects in the GCC. The UAE, particularly in Dubai, it's been not too bad, pretty okay in 2016 and 17 in Dubai. But this year has been a tough year. And I think the outlook for next year is that it's going to get slightly better, but it's still going to be very tough. And a lot will depend on oil prices, because obviously the primary response by governments out here over the past few years has to be to cut back in their own spending program, to bring their own budgets into balance, and to minimize debt growth in their own finances. And if there are concerns that oil is going to not grow strongly, that will reflect in cutbacks in government spending. At the moment, we think governments are going to increase their spending marginally next year. The UAE and the Saudis have announced plans to increase spending. That will lead to an increase in infrastructure taking over from real estate projects, but it's a very fragile recovery.
Very quickly, some of the other stories that you're looking forward to next year. One of them is, outside of the UAE and the Saudi and the big ones that we cover closely, Egypt, you say. Egypt is booming.
Yeah, I think it was interesting to hear the news this morning about the Chinese pulling out of the capital city investment. But Egypt has worked incredibly hard since 2015. They've floated their currency. The government, using the Army Corps of Engineers, have invested heavily in infrastructure projects. You know, they're building about 23 new cities, ranging in size from the new capital city and El Alamein city on the Mediterranean coast to the expansion of various other new cities. They're developing the Suez Canal. They're trying to attract investment into manufacturing. And they've done a very good job of kind of government-led stimulus spending and construction spending. And they're trying to create an environment that's attractive for investors. And I think they've done a very, very good job. And the big gas find, the Zohr gas field find in the Mediterranean, has really transformed the outlook for Egypt's energy sector as well. So I think there are quite a number of pieces falling into place from a government perspective in Egypt. There are still many challenges remaining, which we heard in that interview earlier. But I think Egypt's a very positive story for people in the project sector.
An upbeat note on which to finish. Richard, great talking to you. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Richard Thompson is the editorial director of Mead with his reflections on 2018 and predictions for 2019. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
This is The Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
That's it for the bite-sized business breakfast. We will be back online and on the air 6 a.m. tomorrow morning.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.